I don't have any good excuses for why I'm an alcoholic. There was no moment in my childhood where things were really horrible. You know, there were some bad times, obviously, but generally I was pretty happy as a kid. I moved when I was really young, and, you know, I had, I think, a pretty common experience to most alcoholics. I always kind of felt like I was a little on the outside, even though I had friends. I didn't feel like they were really my friends or, you know, what I just, there was always kind of this, like, this feeling. And that feeling followed me through, like, most of my my young life until as I got older. And I was a pretty late bloomer when it came to alcohol. But my first drink and my first drunk, I was in Mexico. I was drinking with my dad. And we were playing cards and drinking tequila. And the last thing I remember is winning a game of tequila and deciding that we should move the game somewhere else. And then, you know, it gets a little fuzzy. And by fuzzy, I mean like completely black. And so I came back to, and I was in my bed. And I found out months later, because for a while I told this story that I like drank a bottle and a half of tequila. You know, I came back to, I was like, no hangover, all good. You know, like what a big, big, strong man I was. And in reality, I'd been out for 27 hours. My mom had been watering me like a plant. They didn't, you know, trust the local doctors to take care of me. And so I was in a coma, an alcohol-induced coma for that time. And even after, like, finding out the truth about it, I was still, like, so excited and ready to drink again. Because, you know, like, it just seemed like a great time. Like what a cool guy I was. Anyway, high school goes through, I work really, really hard. I get into a good school. And I go to that school and I pretty immediately fall on my face. I didn't have, you know, all the structure that I had had when I was younger. And I got very, very depressed. Before I got depressed, of course, you know, because there was like no one watching, I could drink as much as I wanted. I could smoke as much as I wanted. And I did a lot of that and really didn't go to classes very often. And consequently, whatever, ended up not doing very well in those classes and having to withdraw. I wish it actually had been because I hadn't done well in my classes. I got depressed to the point where I had to be hospitalized. I did a 3-day stay at a psych ward. And then went home. And that was sort of the story for a really long time, where I would go home, clean myself up, and each successive leave, I ended up leaving Brown 4 times. And each successive leave grew less and less glamorous. The first one, I had an internship at Amazon, Microsoft. I worked there and I was doing data analytics and whatever. The next leave, I was working at like this small firm doing some sort of, you know, number, blah, blah. The third time I was delivering pizzas. And the fourth time I was like gambling at a local casino with the money that I should be spending on my education. So it was just like getting better and better, you know? And each and every time I had to write this essay explaining how I was like ready to handle the rigor of Brown University. And each and every time, like the first time, it was like really, you know, sort of like hopeful. I'm going to like go to class and do therapy. And, you know, I never mentioned that I wouldn't drink and I wouldn't drug, which would have been, you know, probably useful. But I really didn't have a solution, right? Like I didn't really know, I guess, what I didn't know. And I hadn't really come to grips with the idea that, you know, there was no universe in which I could use in safety. And so my last leave, I'm living above my parents' garage, and I'm just generally, you know, not a good person. Lots of gambling and drinking and stealing. I had this like fun habit of what I called urban camping, which is where you go out without any money, and you like find your way into a house party or you find your way into like whatever, because it was, you know, fun and exciting. And I was like, you know, not so subtly practicing to be homeless in case my parents kicked me out. And eventually my mom, you know, God bless her and thank God she did. She gave me a choice to either seek, you know, help and treatment or be kicked out. And at that point, you know, I had a little bit of a, I don't know, just a moment where like I knew that the jig was up. I wasn't really ready for a long time after that to really do the work that I needed to do, but that was the start of it. I moved to Boston. I did a program at McLean, and as a part of being in that program, I had to you know, stay sober. So I moved into a sober house because it seemed cheaper than the exorbitant things that we were doing before that to find housing. And as a part of that sober house, I had to go to meetings. And my first meetings, I was not like excited or hyped for. I wasn't sitting in the front row. I wasn't like really doing anything. I was just checking off a box. And for a long time, that's all I did. And for a long time, I didn't get any better. I was miserable. I was just sort of biding my time, hoping that, you know, this would kind of end, or that I would like figure out a way to like outsmart all of the people that were trying to like hold me down or whatever. And in reality, I just really hadn't made the admission that I needed to, that, you know, I'm an alcoholic and that I need to do some work around it. Eventually, you know, I get a little more involved in meetings, and I find a sponsor. This was a sponsor that didn't believe in God, that his first share, and like the only share I'd heard when I asked him to be my sponsor, was that he had been to 10,000 meetings over the many, many years of sobriety that he had. And, you know, he had figured it out, and that like he sort of knew what was going on, and he still goes every once in a while because he feels like he has to. And I was like, that's my guy, you know, like that's the one, like this perfect. And so we started working together, and I had kind of like a partway experience, you know, like I did the steps. I made some amends, and my life got better. I moved out of the sober house that I was in. I started living on my own. I, you know, started seeing someone. I got cats. I got a job and a better job. Like I started to get all of the things that I had wanted in my life. And I was, I mean, not like miserable, but not happy. Like it just wasn't enough. And eventually I stopped going to the meetings that had given me the, you know, experience that I was able to have. And I started like wondering, well, maybe now that I have all the things, it might be okay for me to like drink a little on the weekends, or only have like red wine, or, you know, whatever silly lie I told myself. And so I did. And honestly, like at first it wasn't horrible. Like I didn't, you know, have a few glasses of wine and like immediately fall right on my face. And so I started to kind of believe my own lie. And eventually life lifed pretty hard. I lost a close member of my family. My grandfather passed away, and I finally had a reason to drink and use the way I sort of had always wanted to. I had an excuse. It was like the perfect narrative for my, you know, self-involved pity party. And so when I got back from that funeral and wake, I drank like hard, like really successfully well. You know, I blacked out like super early, and I had no idea where I was still like late into the night. I'm one of those alcoholics that's like really coherent when I'm wasted. I can still order more and more and more booze, which is great, I guess. But it also means that like I really have absolutely no idea where I'm going to end up, what I'm going to end up having to apologize for or do. And it's really, really scary. Oh, geez. So yeah, so then I get sober again, and I started working with a sponsor that actually did the work. I started going to meetings super, super, super regularly. I did a meeting every day for the first 6 months. I got involved in service. I, you know, sort of started collecting home groups like they were going out of style. I just really knew this time around that like a half measure wasn't really going to do it, and that I deserved to give this the sort of whole shot that I needed to. I've heard a lot that, you know, I need to chase my recovery the same way that I chase drugs and alcohol, and that's really been my approach this time around. I'm really grateful that I have people in my life now that I care about and that care about me. I just recently went on a trip to a lovely location for a month. And even in that beautiful place, I missed meetings. Like, I missed you guys. And I went to some meetings out there, and they just, like, weren't really the same. It was, like, great. Like, the message was similar, and it was, you know, a good experience. But anyway, that's all I have to do. So we're good. Thank you, guys.
If you didn't want to be recorded, you could have just said so.
I don't know why it took so long.
Thank you, Socrates. We will now observe the seventh tradition. The seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. We are passing the basket, but you can also observe the seventh tradition digitally on Venmo. There's a QR code in the basket, and our Venmo handle is @BeaconGroup. Although there are no dues or fees for AA membership, we do have expenses. Our rent is $200 per month. Please give what you can and see our treasurer, Megan, over here, for more information or with any questions. We thank you in advance for your generosity. AA also has a set of traditions which apply to the group in the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, Steve has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
Thank you. My name's Steve, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Steve.
One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group shall be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you, Steve. The Beacon Group is run by a business meeting which meets on the third Wednesday of each month directly after the meeting in person and online. That's tonight, guys. Stick around. This is your opportunity to get more involved. All group members are encouraged to attend and participate. We hope you can join us. Will all group members please raise your hands? There's room for one more. And now let's welcome our second 10-minute speaker, Alyssa.
Hi, everyone. My name is Alyssa. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
so it's hard to keep this to 10 minutes, but I'll do my best. I remember, I think Socrates brought it up, that I don't really know the definitive point where I crossed into the life and being of an alcoholic, but I know that it happened, and that's why I'm here. I grew up, and my parents would describe me, like, what kind of child is Alyssa? Like, I was weird. And that has stuck with me. And I think that part of it, the more I learned about my alcoholism, I think I had that sense of terminal uniqueness from, like, a very young age. That, like, I enjoyed being different. I liked not being run-of-the-mill. I had groups of friends everywhere. But deep down inside, I feel like a lot of the friendships and relationships that I had were very surface level and very superficial, that I wasn't really in touch with who I was as a person. And later in life, I turned to alcohol and other mood and mind-altering substances to kind of get me out of that surface level stuff, or so I thought at the time. So my drinking took off at a very young age. And, you know, I'm sure some of you can relate that I tended to surround myself with people that were as bad, if not worse, than I was. So in a room full of drunk people, I could look around and say, all right, I'm not the worst one here. Like, I could take a sigh of relief and think, I'm not that bad. And I know today normal drinkers don't think like that, especially with the people they associate with. By the time I was in high school, I began experimenting with other mind-altering substances. And this is, I think, for me, when things really took off, that my friends at the time could stop drinking on the weekends, and during the week, I would want to keep going. I remained a straight-A student. I don't know how. I never attended class. I'd drink in the parking lot and hang out in the hallway and do my homework for the next day. So it didn't really affect me cognitively yet. I ended up in and out of treatment centers at a very young age. I have a family history of alcoholism and drug addiction. So my mother, like I feel like even before the days of widespread Googling, was able to kind of herself diagnose me, get me into treatment centers. There weren't many treatment centers for adolescents at the time. So by the age of 17, I was sometimes placed in adult treatment centers, and it was scary as all heck. And you would think, again, normal brain, like that scared straight that like, okay, I don't want to end up like that. And I was like, oh no, it's fine. Like I made more friends everywhere I went, every treatment center I went to. I ended up in treatment. I think I was in a halfway house in Tewksbury. And I had tried to drop out of high school at the time. I had kept running into, like, what I kept thinking was rock bottom. I had a few overdoses. There was one time where I overdosed in the backseat of a friend's car, and they drove me from Everett to Swampscott and dumped me in the woods, essentially purple, not breathing. And a woman saw from her window two men carrying a body into the woods and called 911. Thank God for whoever that was, because she saved my life. I received medical treatment, woke up in the hospital, and then this is where the mental obsession part of my disease kicks in. Called my boyfriend at the time, called my dealer at the time, said, I don't care that you just stole my money and my purse and dumped me. Come pick me up at the hospital. And I left the hospital. I tucked and rolled out of my mother's car, stole her phone, did what any good addict alcoholic would do, and went off and running all over again. And that I know now is a part of, it's a symptom of my disease of alcoholism. That need to constantly either need more once it's in my system, or that thought that pops into my head of like, I can't wait to do it again, or I spend all day thinking about, you know, when the liquor store is going to close, how can I plan for the holiday weekend to make sure I have enough? And you know what? It was never enough. So that's when that happened. I ended up going into that halfway house. And while I was there, my mother actually brought my cat to come visit me, which I thought was hilarious, but he was a good boy. So she brought my cat in a newspaper article, and we sat like on the grass outside, and she was like, take a look at this. And it was like, Recovery High School opens in Massachusetts. And I looked at her and I'm like, that's hilarious. Like, I am not going to a sober high school unless they let me have a cigarette break. So we ended up going for an interview. And the first thing I asked the director was, do I get to smoke cigarettes? And she was like, well, we get a fresh air break. And I was like, oh, sign me up. Like, I'm in. Let's do this. So at the time when that recovery school opened, there was a zero tolerance policy. You had to have 30 days sober. If you relapsed, you'd go to treatment, you'd come back, whatever. There was no way that that was going to happen for me. But luckily, while I was there, I was introduced to people who actually worked the steps of this program. So I was introduced into these halls when I was 16 years old. And it took about 3 years before I realized and was told that these steps aren't just something that you read on the wall, like they're action steps that you do. And it blew my mind. Like they had never existed before outside of this banner behind me, that it was just like, all right, check, check. Like I always knew I was powerless, like have at it. But the rest of it was just like, oh, okay. Like I don't understand what any of that meant. So luckily, there was somebody that worked at the school that was familiar with this program and with the 12 steps of AA that in trying to convince me to go to a treatment center, pulled up this beautiful, like, 12-step retreat in New Hampshire and was like, hey, why don't you take a look at this? They have a pool. And I was like, sign me up. Like, this sounds, it's the middle of summer. This sounds like a great idea. So I went there and they actually started taking me through the steps and through the process. And I was able to get sober at age 19 and stay sober for 8 years. Through that process, all of the promises that are laid out in this book started to come true. So what did I do? I stopped doing all of that. And it brought me right back where I was, faster than I ever expected to get there. So what I always thought in my journey of recovery was, I always found, like, again, my terminal uniqueness, the outliers. So I had people in my life, my mother, my sister, who would look at me and say, like, out of genuine curiosity, no harm intended, do you think you'll ever be able to drink again? Like, did you really have a drinking problem, or was it just other stuff? Do you think you grew out of it? So I had these bugs in my head, and that's not to blame them. That's to show that my alcoholism held on to that for, like, 8 years of sobriety, until one day, in sobriety, my life again became unmanageable. I overworked myself. I was in college, working four jobs, doing a Pilates instructor training for 40 hours a week, commuting from Worcester to Arlington to Danvers. I was all over the map, and I wasn't doing any of this work. And my life internally, externally, fine, it looked great on paper. Inside, I was back to where I was. You know, like, the thoughts were only about myself and what was next. I stopped sponsoring people for whatever reason. I stopped writing. I stopped praying. I stopped going to meetings, partially because I thought that starting this sober club on campus at Clark University was, like, that was enough, you know? I was still involved. I was still trying to help other people. But that spiritual loss of values kicked back in, and the selfishness got back to me, and the alcoholism. That one drink, I decided to give up my Pilates training because that was going to be the answer to all of my problems, and to go celebrate the fact that I said, I'm sorry, this is too much, I can't do this anymore, decided to go out and have a glass of wine to celebrate. That celebration lasted for 8 more years. I think the last 2 years of my sobriety, I won't call it recovery because it wasn't, the last 2 years of my sobriety, I was a dry drunk, through and through. So I got to a point after those 8 years that, like, I'm not a little kid anymore. I'm an adult. I realized that I wanted those promises back in my life. My drinking, especially through the pandemic, skyrocketed like you wouldn't believe. I'm sure that that happened for many of us, or we know somebody it had happened to. And I decided that I knew that that treatment program worked. I tried to stop on my own with the help of a substance abuse counselor, and we came up with a plan that if I'm unable to do it on my own, I'll go back and we'll do it again. Since I've been back from that treatment program, I have been working this like my absolute life depends on it, because it does. I have a sponsor that knows she's my sponsor. Her sponsor knows that I'm her grand sponsor. My great-grand sponsor is here tonight. She knows who I am. Like, staying connected, something that I didn't do before, is something that I know in my being I have to do and I have to be mindful of every day of my life in order to keep the promises that are coming true for me again today. That's all I got. Thank you.
Thank you, Alyssa. We encourage all attendees to participate fully in our meetings and to have a service position. If you would like to be of service, please see our jobs coordinator Romero after the meeting. And now let's welcome our main speaker, Chris.
Thank you. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
I want to thank this group for having me here tonight. I basically lived a miserable life. I started drinking when I was 11, and I drank it for 24 years. My sobriety date is September 24, 2013, and my life is really amazing today. I I do, I've had a lot of bad things happen in my life. When I was 11, I had a lot of personal issues. I had a speech impediment, learning disability. I was in special education. And so my perception of myself was, I go to school every day and I watch all the kids go to the regular classes and they're learning and everything. But I have to go to the speech class. I have to go to the special ed class. You know what I mean? So I felt like I'm stupid all the time. You know, because I can't keep up with everybody else. I can't speak to anybody because I'm having a speech problem. So I'm always saying to myself, I always felt like I was stupid. But I always noticed that there was always a group of kids that, to me, seemed like that everything is working for them. Having a good time. They're, going out on parties, hooking up with the girls and all that stuff. And it seemed very popular. And that's what I wanted. I didn't want to feel stupid anymore, okay? I wanted to find a group of kids where I could get involved in and feel like I fit, like I belong. Now, these kids turned out to be troublemakers, and I actually believe that maybe even gang members, I don't know. But they seemed like that they were my type of kids that I wanted to get involved with. So I did. They said, Chris, why don't you meet us out in the, maybe in the woods somewhere. And one night, and I did. One of the kids opened up a book bag, took out a big bottle of hard liquor, opened it and passed it around in a circle. When it got to me, I took a big jug from that bottle. When I burn, I'm sure that all of you know what the burn is, right? When that burn went away, I felt so good that I chased that for 24 years. After a while, when my I don't know who found out first or who contacted first, but when my family and my teachers and everybody noticed who I'm hanging around with, they try to separate me from those kids. When they noticed that I'm starting to drink a lot now, they tried to separate me from the booze. And, of course, I didn't like that because if I have to give up the booze, then I have to go back to the stupid Chris again. So that caused me to get into a lot of fights, a lot of arguments. But my life didn't start to really go downhill. I'm talking about taking a dive down. It was when I got my driver's license. My mother and father were nice enough to help me get a car. I also knew a kid that by giving him a bunch of cash, he'll get me a fake ID. And I actually think that he had a business doing that because he was doing it for everybody. He was making tons of money doing it. So although then my life started to go downhill then, but it was also felt really exciting for me, really exciting because now we have a car. I have a driver's license, and I also have a fake ID, so now I can go to bars, I go to clubs, and I can really have a good time, I can party. This is exciting. But the reason why my life started to go downhill fast, because now I'm starting to drink and drive. And I'll give you an example. I almost killed a family drunk driving. I put them on life support for 2 weeks. Now, after 2 weeks, thank God that they did survive, but I was told I am facing two things. I am facing 20 years per count times three people, which is 60 years. And I was also told that I'm facing a life sentence and I can possibly get out on parole in 20 or 30 years. Why? Because of something I didn't know. When I take a drink, the drink takes me. And I'm not involved in that. When I take a drink, I lose control. And I'm sure that a lot of people have tried to explain that to me. But, of course, I was so asleep and I wasn't listening. Now, even though that they did survive after 2 weeks, but I think it was, I'm not sure if it was the, they couldn't hold me for the homicides. Now, this was approximately, don't really remember, but it was about 20 years ago or so, and the laws were much different back then. But because that family was on life support and they were still alive, They let me out on bail for the drunk driving. So my mother and father were nice enough to bail me out of jail. And they let me move in with them. I don't know why. I mean, all the crap I put them through, the fights, and they were nice enough to let me move in with them. And I'm sitting in my room, and I'm starting to get these massive shakes. I think they call them DTs. Massive shakes, and I'm thirsty, and my body is now yearning for booze. I need booze. Now, there was a problem because I had to get to the liquor store, but I don't have a car because it was destroyed from the accident. Also, my driver's license was suspended. So I had to check at the time. I had to check and see if my mother and father were sleeping because I wanted to steal my father's car. I went upstairs to check, and, you know, they were sleeping, and I kind of went like this. Yes, this is awesome. And I knew where my father kept his key to his car. I took his key, and I snuck out of the house very quietly because I didn't want to make any noise or wake anybody up. So I had to very quietly and very sneaky sneak out of the house, got in the car. I zoomed down the street to the liquor store. And I bought myself a really big bottle of Ruble vodka. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever drank Ruble before, but that's like the bottom of the barrel. It's like drinking rubbing alcohol, you know? But it's good for me. I liked it, you know? Plus, it was cheap. So I bought myself a big bottle, and I'm not sure. I think it was probably the biggest bottle possibly that they had there. I don't know. But I bought a big, really big bottle. I got in the car, and I zoomed home. And I was carrying the bottle, and I very quietly snuck back into the house because I can't wake anybody up, okay? I went to my room. I opened up that bottle. I drank that bottle, and I finished that bottle, and I don't know how I didn't die that night, okay? Now, I do know one thing, though. For me, the amount of booze that I drank that night, you know, forget about the, you know, aside from the rest of my life. But for me to drink that amount of booze at the, you know, at that one time, I have to be insane. So what happened was I'm really, really drunk. I'm walking into the walls, falling down, make a lot of noise. And I woke up my mother and father in the middle of the night. And they're yelling and screaming at me. And this is where it gets very, very sad for me. Because my mother and father are yelling and screaming at me, especially my father, because he's standing there and he's looking at me and he's crying. And he said, "Chris, we don't know if that family is going to survive or not. We don't know if you're going to get 60 years. We don't know if you're going to get a life sentence." You're destroying the family, and you're destroying your own life. What's it going to take to get you to stop drinking? And I'm sitting there, and I'm looking at him, and I just don't care. My brain is so far gone, I just don't care. Because one of the things that my family, they actually thought that maybe this accident, possibly killing a family, maybe this might be a good thing for me. Maybe, because you would think that if something like that happens, you would think that that would have been a sufficiently strong reason to get me to stop drinking, right? Almost killing a family and possibly facing 60 years of life, you would think that that would have been enough. But how come a couple nights after that, I drank a whole bottle of vodka? Because there's something seriously wrong with me. And so I'm so far gone. A lot of things happen. You know, I mean, I can sit here and I can tell you all kinds of stories, all kinds of stuff. I came in. What happened was I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the first time. What I mean by that is this. I do have relapse experience. I have relapsed before. I was going to meetings. I was told I have a sponsor. Now, I don't know if I did or not. Not sure. I mean, I've never called them. I didn't work with them. I never did anything. I was going to meetings and I was going on commitments. I was part of a group, but that's all I was doing. Oh, by the way, several years prior to the accident, my sister got married, and I went to the wedding reception. I met a young girl there. We fell in love. We started dating. We talked a little bit about getting married. So right around that time of the accident, I hope I don't disturb anybody, but during the day, one day, she drove to the Tobin Bridge and got out and jumped to her death. She killed herself. So I've lived a life with a lot of depression in my life. So I was going to meetings and everything, but that's all I was doing. But I had a lot of things going on the inside. A lot of, they call it a spiritual malady, which is an internal condition. Some examples. I mean, they talk about it in the book, too. I mean, look, everything that they talk about in the book happened to me, like the restless, irritable, discontent. That's me. You know, restless, like I can't find a place where I can fit. I'm like a dog. I'm like a dog circling around the room trying to find a spot to lay down and fit. And I can't find that spot. I'm irritable. Irritable means I'm easily annoyed. And discontent. Discontent means I am never satisfied. Spiritual living is, am I totally at peace with the way it is? If I'm not totally at peace with the way it is, then I have discontent. Restless, irritable, discontent. So I was suffering from a lot of that. I also had problems with personal relationships. I was suffering from depression. I had all of these things going on inside me. And just coming to meetings, I stayed sober for 2 years, and just coming to meetings and not drinking wasn't working for me. I tried my best, but what happened was after 2 years, I had no choice but to break out and start drinking again. Now, I wasn't, oh, by the way, I don't know, if you're like me, alcoholics don't have denial, we have delusion. I wasn't thinking about all the years prior where all of the misery and pain happened. The only thing I was thinking about was the early days of my drinking, when I was going out with the other guys, hanging out, partying, having a great time, and everything is wonderful. I really thought, and I convinced myself, that if I try hard enough, because I know I'm not stupid, I'm smart, and I believe that if I try hard enough, that I can go back to the early days when everything was great. And I'll tell you, the next 2 years of my life was absolutely horrible. Now, I am 45 years old. Those 2 years that I drank for, that I relapsed for, were the worst, horrific 2 years out of the 45 years I've been on this planet. I was living in my own apartment, River Street in Waltham. I still live there, and I moved in there, and the place was pretty decent when I moved in. I mean, it was a nice place, but I destroyed that place, shaking all the time, throwing up constantly, the dry heaves. I'm not trying to make anybody sick or anything, but I'm just trying to describe. So very, very sick. I mean, I had ants in my kitchen, ants in my bathroom. I mean, I am pissing in bottles. Because I can't stand on my own 2 feet. Because now at this time, I'm not just drinking. I'm smoking massive amounts of marijuana. I'm swallowing all different kinds of pills, mixing everything together. I mean, I'm really screwed up. And I'm like really, really nasty, disgusting condition of living. What happened was a lot of people tried to contact me. And because I just all of a sudden disappeared. I was suspended from work, and especially my family, because I just disappeared for a long period of time. I'm not responding to any calls, not answering my phone, not responding to any messages. I'm just sitting there getting all screwed up in my apartment, and I don't give a crap about anything or anyone. So what happened was my father and my sister, They told my mother to stay home because my mother is a very emotional person. I had a little window when I'm sitting in the chair. I look up, but kind of like up there, little window. I could see the parking lot out there, and I could see cars kind of driving by, stopping, you know, the park looking at me, saying, who the hell is this crazy whack job in there? And I remember one time my father came up and knocked on the window like that. Get up. And I'm like this, and he walks away. And so I think people kind of had an idea. So they were concerned that if they were to show up in my apartment and saw me in a very, very bad place, they thought that my mother might have a nervous breakdown. She's a very emotional person. So they told my mother to stay home. My father and my sister came by. The landlord let them in and saw me on the floor. And I really do believe that was the grace of God that came into my life. And this is why. If my father and my sister did not come that night, I honestly do believe deep down within my heart that if nobody came, I would have went to sleep and never woke up. I would have been found dead. So what happened was they picked me up off the floor, you know, in this horrible condition. They had to carry me outside, rush me to the emergency room. When I left there, they sent me to the Veterans Hospital in Bedford. And I was in that psychiatric hospital for I don't remember how long, but I was spending a lot of time with a psychiatrist there because when I was out cold, how much time do we have? Oh, plenty of time. Am I running out of time? When I was out cold, I was speaking, not realizing that I was speaking, but I basically said that the reason why I'm doing this is because I want to kill myself. That's why I'm doing it. So that's why I spend a lot of time there. So, and since I left there, it was over 10 years ago, and I have a sponsor. I work with them every week, and my life has changed physically, mentally, and spiritually. Just one other thing that I do want to mention, and then I'll end because I know it's time. I don't want to go over. But what really, really gets me motivated to do all of this stuff is my first step. For me, the first step is a funnel, and at the bottom, I had two options. Do I want to live on a spiritual basis, or do I want to die an alcoholic death? And the reason why that's important for me is because it got me very open-minded about God. When I went through the first step and I saw that this is me, it got me very open-minded about God. So I have a higher power in my life today. My life is really amazing. How much time do I actually have?
You have about 10 minutes left.
Oh, 10 minutes left? Oh, I was thinking it was over. Okay. Well, sorry about that. Sorry. Okay. Well, okay. Because I was thinking something else. But thank you. Okay. So it's really the first step that really got me motivated to do all of this stuff. One of the questions that that I ask people that I sponsor, by the way, I don't just say that I work the steps. Go through the first 9 steps every year with my sponsor. The reason why is because I need to stay current in my life. All of the things that's happened to me years ago, I've already cleaned up. I made all of the amends, paid all the money back. So now I need to stay current. Because sometimes I do fall asleep and I do get resentments and I do get fear. So I always have to go back through that. So one of the questions that I ask people that I sponsor, and also my sponsor asks me this every year, is part of the second step, which I think is very profound. Do I believe, or am I willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself that can take me past here? is their dimensions of wonder, joy, love, service, pain, far beyond every experience I've ever had. Is there more past here? Yes. So if I tell people that I work the steps, that's like saying that there's no more God for me, right? So every time I go through the steps, the steps is like, I could describe it like this. The steps is like a Cheech and Chong moment for me. You know, it's like amazing. It's like mind-altering drug. It's, you know, I always find stuff that I have to do. You know what I mean? And it's really, really amazing. So I really do have to stay current in my life. What I do is I do practice a 10th, 11th step every day, and my sponsor is very strict with that. The 10th step is what I do when my hand is on the door and I come out and interact with you. The 11th step I do at home in the morning, and I do at home in the evening. A lot of questions when I open up the book to Upon Awakening. There's a bunch of questions I ask myself, and I go out with my life. And the best way I could describe it is this. In the morning, I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. My alarm goes off. My feet are on the floor. And then after a little bit of coffee, I opened up my book to Upon Awakening. And there's a whole bunch of questions there. So I'm online, a line of the will, right? So I put my hand on the door and I go outside and I see that somebody's parked behind me, right? So now I'm offline. Now I'm way over there, right? So I say a prayer, thy will not mine be done, and I'm back in line again. Line of the will, right? I get in my car, go down to Dunkin' Donuts. Usually, because early in the morning, usually there's nobody there. But sometimes when I go there, there's somebody there in line and she can't figure out what the hell she wants, right? And she really aggravates me, pisses me off because I have to get to work, right? And also she is creating this long line behind me. So what do I do? I mean, it talks about what I do in a 10th step, right? What do I do? I pause when I'm agitated or doubtful. Pause is a spiritual practice, right? I turn away from myself. I turn out of myself. I turn to someone I can help. Turn is a spiritual practice, right? I cease fighting everything and everyone, including alcohol. And someone said to me one day, what does that mean? It means I cease fighting, right? Traffic, crazy whack jobs out there, which are everywhere, right? I cease fighting, you know? I don't have to fight anymore, you know? So I have all of these spiritual practices that I have in the 10th, 11th step that I use as self-awareness, where I have these tools where I can bring myself back online. It's called the line of the will, right? And I was talking about this with my sponsor, is that he said, Chris, there is a theory that God gave us free will, I think, right? It could be true, right? And he said, Chris, if you were to look at the framework of steps 4 through 9, what do? They take your will and they align it with God's will. And when you get to the 10th step, they call it a line of the will, right? So that's what I do to stay in fit spiritual condition. Because, you know, I do all of this stuff because I don't know the day or the time my brain is going to say, let's drink again. That could come at any time. It could come at any day. But I have a higher power in my life that I call God that comes between me and that thought taking place. Because God has more power than booze, right? Right? So that's what I've been doing for the past 10 years. And my life is really, really, really amazing. I made all my amends. I've cleaned everything up. So now I need to stay current. And one other thing I do, when I make amends, right, I don't just go out and apologize, okay? Let's say, like for an example, let's say if I say something or do something bad to, I don't know, just to Amanda, right? Right? Now, I will never intentionally do anything bad to Amanda. But the reason why I would is because I'm asleep, because I'm asleep, not present to what I'm doing. So if I am made aware of it, I will go to Amanda and say, Amanda, this is what I did. That was bad. How can I make it right? And then she will tell me what I have to do to make it right. And we call that an Alcoholics Anonymous. We call that taking action to make a correction. It is called corrective action. Okay? There is no corrective action in just apologize. I mean, I've apologized thousands of times in my life. Oh, Mom, Dad, I'm sorry for this. I'm sorry for that. You know, hundreds of times. My father says, Chris, we don't give a crap anymore. You're this still piece of crap you've always been. You know? See, if you're like me, I have to make corrections in my life, you know? And I can't just let things go. I was told that those people, you know, there are a lot of other things that has happened in my life, but I was told that family and that accident. A few weeks ago, right after my 10th year anniversary, I was at work and I sat down and I took a break and I was just thinking of a few things and I said, wow, this is amazing. I'm sober 10 years now. And then I realized something dawned on me. I realized that the longer I'm sober, the bigger my prayer list becomes. I keep adding people onto my prayer list, right? So one of the things that I do with that family that I'd almost killed, because I can't contact them, I have a no contact order. And so what I do is I say prayers for them. You know, I say prayers for them. And I just hope, I mean, I don't know if they're okay today. I mean, I don't know what's going on with them. I have no idea. And, you know, there are some situations where I just can't make amends. But I do believe there was another incident where I almost killed other people, but that involved a police officer drunk driving. You know, if I were to encounter that police officer or that other two or three people in that car, some point in my life, I will make amends to them, okay? But my sponsor told me that this is not something that I have to go out and seek out these people. But I do have a lot of people that I have to pray for. I do say prayers for myself, but I pray mostly for the people, and I pray less for myself. And that's how I have peace of mind today, you know? And it's really, really amazing life today. So, guess what? 1 minute left. So that's the end of the meeting. So what do we do? I hope this meeting was great. I hope it was useful to everybody. And so do I close it out? No? Okay. Thank you.